The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the 20th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, January 17th, 2026.
Well, today we do want to pick up this continuing saga, if you will, of the storylines in the books of Samuel or the books of the Kings. And so we are now covering the early life of David in 1 Samuel. And if you recall now from the last installment, I'll call it an installment, that's what it was. The last time I spoke to you here in this series, we covered the very last part of chapter 18 of 1 Samuel and all of chapter 19. And that installment in chapter 19, we saw that Saul offered David one of his daughters in marriage. He rejected the oldest daughter. He accepted ultimately Saul's request for him to marry his youngest daughter, Michal. And Michal is the one who actually loved David. And so David accepted that. Saul did it all in order to trip up David. Saul's goal is to kill David. And so he tried to use a marriage as a means, or a promise of a marriage as a means, to get David to be reckless out on the battlefield and to get himself killed. That didn't happen because God is backing him up all along the way. So then we saw at the very end of chapter 19, Saul's latest attempt literally to kill David. Now this is from chapter 18 and through 19. We've had three different attempts on the life of David directly by Saul. So we saw in the very end of chapter 19, where we left off, was the final documented attempt on his life, when literally he's sending his soldiers to arrest him at home. His wife, David's wife, gets wind of it, helps David escape out through the window so that he's already long gone by the time the soldiers show up. We saw Saul now is furious at his daughter because he knows she tipped him off. She lies to her father and says, well, David made me or threatened my life if I didn't help him escape. So good for Michal that she helped him escape. And it's understandable from her standpoint, the fact of then trying to protect herself from her father's wrath, especially because he's so mentally unstable. But that's how we left it off at the end of chapter 19. So now we're going to pick it up and carry forward. I'm going to try and get through all of this chapter 20, which is a little bit difficult because there's 40-something verses in this, but we're going to try to accomplish it. So 1 Samuel 20 now, beginning in verse 1. Oh yeah, I forgot the very last part of that chapter. If you remember now, David flees, and where did he go? He went to Ramah, which is the hometown of Samuel the prophet. So in other words, he flees to Samuel. Remember, Saul sends out multiple bands of soldiers to try and arrest David there, and all three different bands are overwhelmed by the inspiration coming from the Levites who are, and I proposed, are singing. Their prophesying was in the form of song, which touched the hearts of these men, and all of them join in. So instead of carrying out their duty of the king in order to arrest David, instead they all become overwhelmed emotionally and join in with this celebration and this worship of God. And then Saul comes himself and does exactly the same thing. So that's how we left off the end of chapter 19. So chapter 20, verse 1, and David fled from Naoth in Ramah, which is where this worship had been going on, and came and said before Jonathan. Okay, stop right there. So where did David go? Well, so David flees from Gibeah, the court, the royal court of Saul, to Naoth here in Ramah. The soldiers come, Saul comes, and it appears he turned around and went right back now to Gibeah. So now Saul and this band of soldiers are still in Ramah. David's now back where they started, because now he's having this conference with Jonathan. David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, What have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before thy father that he seeks my life? David is perplexed because he has showed nothing but respect and honor for Saul and for his role as God's anointed, as king of Israel. He's done nothing whatsoever to undermine Saul. And so he honestly is upset and perplexed because the king keeps trying to kill him. Verse 2, and he, Jonathan, said unto him, David, God forbid, thou shalt not die. Behold, my father will do nothing, either great or small, but that he will show it to me. And so Jonathan's trying to calm David down and saying, don't worry, because, you know, I'm in the inner circle of my father. I'm, in fact, the oldest son. I'm the heir apparent for the throne, which means I have his confidence, and he's not going to do anything that I'm not going to be involved in. In other words, Jonathan's saying, I'm your intelligence. I'm the one that gives you the inside intel on what's going on, which means long before my father can ever create a new plot to kill you, I'm going to know about it, and I'll tip you off. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. So Jonathan's not worried. And he has absolute confidence that he's always going to be in the confidence of his father. Verse 3, David disagrees. So here, literally, David and Jonathan have a disagreement. And David swore moreover and said, thy father certainly knows that I have found grace in thy eyes. David's saying, no, Jonathan, you're wrong. Your father knows that you and I have a covenant of friendship. And he is already in the process of cutting you out because of past events that have taken place where you've tipped me off. You're not going to be able to tell me. Thy father certainly knows that I have found grace in thy eyes. And he said, let not Jonathan know this. In other words, he's saying, and Saul's already telling his other inner circle not to let you know what he's planning, lest he be grieved. But truly as the eternal liveth, David continues to say, and as thy soul liveth, there is but a step between me and death. David is saying, no, my life is in great jeopardy. And Jonathan, for all you being well-meaning, you're losing your ability to help protect me because your father is going to start cutting you out of the intel. Verse 4, then said Jonathan unto David, whatsoever thy soul desires, I will even do it for you. So they're not going to get in a fight over and argue about it. Jonathan's just saying, regardless of what's in my father's mind, he says, I'm on your side, and I'm going to go to bat. You can depend upon me. Verse 5, and David said unto Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at meat. So we've got a lot to talk about as a little tangent here on this thing of new moon celebration. Tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at meat, but let me go that I may hide myself in the field unto the third day at even. Okay, what is going on? What new moon is this? We understand that new moons mark the beginning of every month, new month in God's calendar. All right, and that's, as we're going to see, that is the importance of a new moon. It's like, when does the calendar tick over from one month to another month? It's day one of the next month corresponds to the astronomical new moon. Okay. And so here we find that there is a special celebration taking place on every new moon. Well, why? Well, first I want to refer you back. If you want more information on new moons and what God wants us to do or cares for us to do on new moons, I did a sermon all the way back in 2010, in fact, May 8, 2010, about new moons. So I highly recommend, if you have any questions over if there's something residual today that God expects us to be doing on new moons, that you go back and listen to that sermon. Or there's a lot of other material from our historical church that you can look up. The reason this is important is because there are a number of Church of God people at large today who have decided, unlike what they learned, what we all learned through Mr. Armstrong and our parent church, that new moons are Sabbaths and that they need to be kept like weekly Sabbaths and holy days, okay? And the reason is because there's a number of commands in the Bibles to have, to set aside and do special things on the beginning, the first day of every new month, including animal sacrifices in the Old Covenant. Let's look at just a couple of those. I'm going to just briefly touch on this to kind of cover it so we can move on. Numbers 28. Numbers 28, verse 1. I'm going to read some passages and skip through the first half. The Eternal spake unto Moses, saying, command the children of Israel, and saying to them, my offering, my bread for my sacrifice is made by fire for a sweet savor unto me, shall you observe to offer unto me in their due season. And thou shalt say unto them, this is the offering made by fire, which you shall offer unto the Eternal, two lambs of the first year without spot. And how often? So the first sacrifice here in Numbers 28 that is mentioned is on what frequency? Day by day. What are we talking about? That's a day that we otherwise call that the daily sacrifice. Okay? So the first sacrifice that was commanded by God as a part of the temporary law, the sacrificial system, which was, by the way, done away by the coming and the qualification of Jesus Christ, was the daily sacrifice. Every single day of every single year, there was a morning sacrifice and an evening sacrifice. Now, what does that have to do with anything? I thought we were talking about new moons. I'll connect the dots here quickly. But the first one listed for special sacrifices were offerings every single day. Four, he says, a continual burnt offering, a continual. And all these people, Church of God people who should know better, by the way, and yet now are adding to the commands and saying that we're supposed to be keeping every new moon day 12 times during the year as a Sabbath. It's a continual. It's not been done away. Okay, skip down to verse 9. And on the Sabbath day, two lambs of the first year without spot, 2/10 deal of flour for meat offering mingled with oil and the drink offering thereof. Verse 10, this is the burnt offering of every Sabbath beside the continual burnt offering. So before these daily sacrifices, on the Sabbaths, then there was always supposed to be an offering. By the way, the spiritual equivalent, since we're not sacrificing animals, is what you're doing right now. Having a convocation now in a designated place that God has selected and appearing in his midst. And you are offering sacrifices, by the way, right now, by your presence and your participation. All right, that's the spiritual fulfillment of the Old Testament animal sacrifices. So daily sacrifices, and now we've got sacrifices on the Sabbath, verse 11, and when else? And in the beginning of your months, you shall offer a burnt offering unto the Eternal. Carries on. So here's another time. In the beginning of every month, God said, which is where this new moon celebration comes from. Skip to the very end of verse 13, and then the summation says, this is the burnt offering of every month throughout the months of the year. So God wanted Israel to do something special on the new moons, every single beginning of every month through the year. The rest of chapter 28 and all of chapter 29 specifies further special sacrifices commanded on all the annual Sabbaths. So the fact that you've got all this together, there's the weekly Sabbath, special sacrifices. All the annual holy days, special sacrifices. New moons, also special sacrifices. So new moons are supposed to be treated like Sabbaths. And my answer is, then what about the daily sacrifice? What about the daily sacrifice? If every time God commanded a sacrifice, that's a holy day, then that means every single day of the year is a holy day, and you have to treat it like a Sabbath. How are you going to get away from the daily sacrifice? A morning and an evening sacrifice. No time to do any work. Turn with me quickly to Numbers 10 and verse 10. Numbers 10 and verse 10. Also in the day of your gladness and in your solemn days. All right. So there's some category of days which God is calling here solemn days. Those truly are Sabbaths, holy days, by the way. In your solemn days and, it didn't say in your solemn days including the beginning of your months. It's got two different categories. You've got solemn days and you've got the beginning of months. Are they the same? No. which means beginning of month days are not solemn days. They're special days. They're marked up by God for a special remembrance, but they're not in the same category as solemn days. In your solemn days and in the beginning of your months, you shall blow with the trumpet over your burnt offering and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings, that they may be to you for a memorial before your God. What do they all have in common? Sacrifices on the holy days as well as on the new moons were all memorials. They were intended to remind Israelites to look back at something. Something that God considered important and he wanted it to be in the front of their minds. They're all called memorials. Turn with me quickly to 2 Chronicles 2, verse 4. Sorry for speeding through this, but this really is a tangent. And I do strongly urge you to go back and at least listen to my message from 2010 for the details. 2 Chronicles 2, verse 4. Behold, God says, I build an house to the name of the Eternal my God to dedicate it to him and to burn before him sweet incense and for the continual showbread. So this is now in the creation of the temple, the starting of the formal temple worship services, including all these sacrifices once Solomon's temple was built. And for the burnt offerings, morning and evening, there's a reference to the daily sacrifice two times a day. Here's the list. When Solomon's temple first opened for business, if you will, and the full sacrificial system to honor God was instituted in that building, what all were they doing? Here's the list. Burnt offerings morning and evening, every single day, on the Sabbaths, and on the new moons. Have I convinced you yet that new moons are a separate category from Sabbaths? I hope so. That's my intent. New moons have a purpose, and God wants us to be aware of them, but they are not Sabbaths. And on the solemn feast, meaning those annual holy days of the Eternal your God, this is an ordinance forever to Israel. So the new moons were important, but they were not Sabbaths. If you want to know the list of Sabbaths, Leviticus 23. We don't have to turn there, but you are very familiar with it. Leviticus chapter 23 gives you the full, complete, exhaustive list of every Sabbath as God defines it, both the weekly Sabbath and all the annual Sabbaths. They're all there, and you will not find new moons mentioned in Leviticus 23 because it's not a Sabbath. So the problem and the reason a number of these well-meaning, however misguided, members of the Church of God at large have latched onto and today actually keep every new moon day as a Sabbath is because of these commands to do offerings. There's also examples in other prophetic books of the Bible that show, I think in the book of Amos, that shows that they were literally closing the city gates in Jerusalem on the new moons, which means now they did that on the Sabbaths. But all that means is that they treated the new moon day as a business holiday. They basically closed the gates so that normal business activity did not take place on the new moon. That does not mean it's a Sabbath. But it was, in essence, a national holiday. And what we find that King Saul was doing with the Israelites in the time that we're reading about in 1 Samuel chapter 20, they were at least in part honoring God's command to set the new moon days apart. What were they doing? Having a feast. So back to chapter 20 and now verse 5. So here we saw that David specifically referred to, he says, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at meat, meaning a special meal that took place in the king's court on every new moon day. And David was expected to be there. He had always been there. And so here it was, this day he had to flee from Saul, and now he's fled back to Gibeah, and the next day following is the new moon day when he's expected to be in the court. So supposedly Saul is not trying to kill him anymore. I mean, first he's trying to kill him, then he's not trying to kill him. Oh, it's okay, don't worry. And then he's back to trying to kill him again. All right, so now Saul's had a change of mind again because he's been overwhelmed by the Levites' music in Ramah. And so now Saul's not trying to kill him. So David should just forget it's ever, the three times that's already happened, he should just forget about that and show up like nothing ever happened in the king's court to celebrate the new moon with the feast. And David's going, I'm in danger. He says, I'm this far away from being killed. So, and I think I failed to mention the fact, what is the real intent and what is it that we do with new moons today? Mr. Raymond Cole was the one, through wisdom and God's inspiration, who showed us why are the new moons important to God and why are they set apart? Because they only when you know the new moon days do you also know how to calculate when the holy days fall. It's about the calendar. The reason new moons are important, God never commands anything for no reason. Why did he tell ancient Israel to do special sacrifices and treat new moon days as a business holiday when they weren't Sabbaths? To focus the entire people of Israel on the fact that this is the declared new moon. The Levites were the ones who declared the new moon day. And then you would know in the particular months when holy days fall, like the first month, you know how to calculate when Passover and unleavened bread come. How can you know when the 14th day of the first month is if you don't know when the first day of the first month is? Because you count the 14th away from the first, don't you? How do you know when to keep the Passover, which is very critical? How do you know when the first high day of unleavened bread and the last high day of unleavened bread, which is the 15th day of the first month and the 21st day of the first month? How can you know which days those are if you don't know when New Year's Day is? That's why new moons were important. They weren't Sabbaths, but they were markers. So every new moon throughout the year, including all of the months that don't contain holy days, were also included in this because for trumpets, by the way, which is the only new moon, by the way, which falls on a holy day because the Feast of Trumpets happens to be the first day of the seventh month. So trumpets actually falls on the new moon day. It's the only of God's annual holy days which actually falls on a new moon. That's the only new moon we keep as a Sabbath. None of the rest are Sabbaths, but they're important to know when they are. How can you know when trumpets comes if you don't know and count all the other months in the year that lead up to the seventh month? You got to know month 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 in order to know when 7 comes. So every new moon was important for counting purposes. And that's why God made the Israelites treat those new moon days differently, so that they would know when and how to keep the annual holy days that fell throughout the year, either in the first month, in the third month for Pentecost, or else in the seventh month. Okay, back to the storyline. So David in verse 5 of chapter 20 of 1 Samuel, and I'm going to read this now from, because the next question we have is, why does he mention 3 days? The next question is, wait, well, how long were they, you know, was it just the new moon day they had the feast? No, there was at least 2 days of feasting going on. The new moon day actually and the day that followed it, day 2 of the month. And so we don't really get a great explanation of why they were keeping it on 2 days. Well, there are all kind of scholars who give you all kind of answers for that, and I'm not going to belabor you with that for the moment. But this was a 2-day feasting period every single month. And I like it here because David had said, tomorrow is the new moon and I should not fail to sit with the king at meat, but let me go that I may hide myself in the field unto the 3rd day at even. At even. Now we're talking about at sunset. Are we talking about sunset after the end of the 3 days, or are we talking about sunset at the beginning of the 3rd day? And now, does this remind you of the Pentecost count issue? It does me. Now we've got this issue. How long was David hiding? Waiting here. You've got a count concerning a 3rd day, and you've got an evening. And the evening and the morning is the way God counts a day. The day begins at evening, at sunset, and ends at the following sunset. How long is David hiding, and what are we talking about here? And the scholars, by the way, because they're also confused on counting Pentecost, they're also confused in a number of cases on counting this. But I'm going to give you the answer. I like the NIV English translation on this part of verse 5, so let me read it to you. So David said, "Look, tomorrow is the new moon feast, and I am supposed to dine with the king, but let me go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow." This is really well said. What really this is talking about. Here is the day or the afternoon that Jonathan and David are having this powwow, trying to come up with a plan for how they're going to figure out what Saul's going to do so they can keep David from being killed. David is expected to show up for this feast when? The next day. Okay? David says he's going to hide out until the feast is over. And then they're going to see how the lay of the land is stacking up. All right, so I like this, is that in essence, so he's gonna live rough in the field or out in the wilderness tonight, which is the night the new moon begins. Also the following night, at the end of day one, at the beginning of day two, and the following night at the end. So there's gonna be three nights or three parts of days that we're dealing with. But how many days were they feasting? 2 days. And I think that fits with everything we're going to see. What is Saul's intent? And here's the next question as we get into verse 6. Can Jonathan really be trusted? Now, we read these stories. I'm just going to call to attention to you to make you back up and question or reevaluate just the presumptions you and I make, we read the story. And you take for granted, well, of course, Jonathan was a faithful friend. How many faithful friends have there ever been in the world, the way human nature is? How many examples are there when people who are supposedly your friend will stab you in the back? And especially when you're talking about life and death decisions, and that's exactly what David and Jonathan were involved in here. You're talking about the highest level of politics going on in Israel with the king of Israel and his son, his heir, and this one now that the king hates more than anyone else, which is David, who he desperately wants to get rid of. So Jonathan has made this commitment to David. Don't worry, David, I've got your back. And it's easy for you and me to say, well, yeah, of course, Jonathan's going to be a rock. He's going to be faithful. But look at the faith it would take in order for David literally to trust him, because David is literally putting his life in Jonathan's hands, depending upon Jonathan to follow through and do what he said. What is Saul's intent, and can Jonathan be trusted? That's what this next passage is going to show us. Verse 6, David continues by saying, "If thy father at all miss me." So here he's supposed to be at this new moon feast the next day. David's not going to show up. And David is using this as a way to test the real thinking and the orientation of mind of Saul. Is Saul really favorable toward David like he's claiming? And like bygones be bygones and we're back to normal? Or is Saul waiting for a new opportunity, literally, to assassinate him? That's the question they want to answer. And David says, "If your father at all misses me at the meal tomorrow, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me that he might run to Bethlehem, to his city, his birth city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family." So his family would be celebrating the new moon as well with the feast. And in essence, David says to Jonathan, if your father misses me because I'm not at the table in his court, tell him that I'm keeping the new moon with my family in Bethlehem. For there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. If he say thus, it is well. And if Saul says to you, Jonathan, that's okay. Thy servant shall have peace. Meaning, I know I'm okay with Saul. He really is at peace with me and he's not trying to kill me. But if he be very wroth, if he gets mad because I'm not there, then be sure that evil is determined by him. If your father is mad that I'm not there, it will be proof he was looking for a new opportunity to kill me. Did David actually go to Bethlehem to keep the new moon feast with his family? Some scholars say, well, maybe he did. He had, what, a couple of days instead of just kind of hunkering down out in a rocky field, which maybe he did. He could have. It's only like 5-6 miles away back to his hometown. Maybe he did. But is that the intent? Is that, if he did, is that why he went? No. Is David and his Jonathan partaking of a lie right now? Yes. They're making up a story. They're literally breaking one of the commandments. I just want to point that out. Now, they're doing it for a good reason, right? Would you and I be justified in doing that? Concocting a plan to lie in order to keep ourselves out of trouble. Isn't that what Michael did? She lied to her father and said, oh, I only helped him because he threatened to kill me if I didn't help him escape. The same kind of duplicity is going on now, conjured up by David and Jonathan together to tell a lie. Not because they're trying to take advantage of anyone, if you want to call that a white lie, which is what human beings do. But I just want to be upfront about what's going on here. So David comes up with the lie and says, if your father misses me and says, where's David? Tell him this lie to explain why I'm not there. Verse 8, therefore thou shalt deal kindly with, meaning if he's mad, Saul's going to tip his hand and prove he's still out to get David. Therefore thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant. And here David is still referring to Jonathan with the respect of his royal title as a prince, which I think is interesting. They're best friends. They've already committed to each other in covenant relationship, a friendship. That was back at the beginning of chapter 18. But David is still respects the office of Saul as king, and he still respects the office of Jonathan, his firstborn, as the heir to the throne. Therefore, David says, thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant. He calls himself the servant of Jonathan. For thou hast brought thy servant into a covenant of the eternal with thee. He says, he's reminding him back after the defeat of Goliath. And then Jonathan and David were knit together as best friends and entered into a covenant of friendship. And David's reminding Jonathan of that. Notwithstanding, he says, if there be in me iniquity, if there's some hidden agenda with me, if I'm just shining you on, making friends with you because I'm trying to take advantage of the fact of your position in the royal court of your father, he says, slay me yourself. Kill me yourself. For why should thou bring me to thy father? So David's acknowledging the possibility that Jonathan's taken a risk here by extending himself out to be the friend of David, who his father's trying to kill because his father sees David as a threat to his throne. And David's not just dismissing that concern. He's saying to Jonathan, it's like, you need to be sure, because you don't want to be bringing a true enemy into the court of your father. If I have an evil motive, you should just kill me now. So he's forcing Jonathan literally to think seriously about what he's about to do. This is David's humble, urgent plea for Jonathan to commit, to recommit to this binding covenant they've made together. Not just some generic act of kindness, yeah, you're my bestie. This is serious, and it's life-impacting. It's a covenant-keeping faithfulness in a life-or-death situation. It really is life or death. Verse 9, now here's Jonathan's reply. Jonathan said, far be it from thee, meaning that I'm going to kill you. For I knew certainly that if I knew certainly that evil were determined by my father to come upon thee, then would not I tell thee? He says, don't you believe that if I find out, or if I discover that it is my father's true intent to assassinate you, do you have any doubt that I'm going to actually warn you and let you know? Jonathan's saying, I'm committed to defending you and helping you. no matter what it costs me personally. So Jonathan is confirming he's serious about his covenant with David. And now, verse 10, we find, whereas before David was asking Jonathan for a recommitment to their covenant of friendship, now Jonathan is turning the tables, and he's going to ask for something from David. Verse 10, and then said David to Jonathan, "Who shall tell me?" Meaning now we're down to the mechanics of how I'm going to get a warning, because I'm going to be out in the field. I'm not coming into the court. You're going to be there. You're going to have the intelligence. You're going to get the intel to figure out, is your father really still seeking to kill me or not? But how are you going to send me the message so that I find out the truth? Who shall tell me? Is Jonathan just going to send one of his servants out there? David, where are you? I've got a message from Jonathan. Well, that doesn't make sense. So they got to come up with some sort of a scheme to communicate, just like spies. Who shall tell me? Or what if thy father answers thee roughly? What if your father actually gets angry at you? And boy, is that prophetic, because that's exactly what's going to happen. What if your father answers you roughly? And Jonathan said unto David, "Come and let us go out into the field." And they went out, both of them, into the field. This is outside then the city walls. And it doesn't mean, I originally read this and I think like a wheat field, you know, full of crops. And apparently that's not the case. We're talking about a rough field, and a lot of scholars say probably strewn with a lot of boulders of all sizes. Okay, so it's a good place literally to hide. Jonathan said, and they went out, both of them, into the field. And Jonathan said, verse 12, to David, "O Lord God of Israel," which I find interesting, because now who is Jonathan addressing? He's talking to David, and yet he's actually addressing God. So Jonathan says, "O eternal God of Israel, when I have sounded my father about tomorrow, when I've tested the waters to find out what my father is really thinking, when I've sounded my father about tomorrow, any time, or the third day." Oh, see, there's 3 days, not 2 days. How many days were they feasting? Just the new moon and the day after, or was there a third day involved? Again, we're back to this issue about when does the third day begin? At sunset, when the second day ends, right? And that's really what we're talking about. So any time after sunset at the end of day two is already into the third day. And as we're going to see in the story, when is this information going to pass between Jonathan and David to let him know? The next morning. So it really is on the third day when David finds out the answer to the question, is your father still trying to kill me or not? All right, so you've got the new moon day, you've got the second day after, they're both feast days, and then you've got the morning of the third day, which is when David's going to find out whether he needs to run or not. "And behold, if there be good toward David," if the news is good, Saul's not trying to kill him, "and I then send not unto you and show it you." Remember, Jonathan is addressing God. And he's saying, "I've committed to send a message to David to let him know, to save his life if he's in danger." And he's saying to David before God, or to God before David. And he's saying, "If I fail to follow through and show it to David," verse 13, "the Eternal do so and much more to Jonathan. Then whatever befalls David, let that in God's righteousness happen to me. But if it please my father to do the evil," if it's true that King Saul is looking for an opportunity to assassinate David, "then," he says, "I will show it to you and send you away that you may go in peace." I'm going to help save your life by tipping you off so that you can run and save your life. "And the Eternal be with you as he hath been with my father." So Jonathan is reconfirming his commitment to this friendship and this covenant with David. No matter what risk, he takes himself personally. He says, I'm serious about this. And he says, if I fail to follow through, he says, then may God do to me the same. Verse 14, he continues on, and thou shalt not only, so Jonathan's saying to God, I'm putting my life in your hands and I'm making a promise before God that I'm going to follow through and do the right thing. And if I don't, let me die. And in exchange, he's bargaining. Jonathan is bargaining here with God and David. Verse 14, and thou shalt not only, while yet I live, show me the countenance of the Eternal that I die not. He says, in response to my faithfulness to this covenant of friendship, which is putting my own life in jeopardy, by aligning with David, he's taken the ultimate risk. He's a traitor to his father and to the court of Israel. He's knowingly making this decision because he believes that God is backing up David. He is convinced that David is the one that God has picked for the future. And so now Jonathan is seeking favor from God and from David. He says, I'm putting myself out to help you. When you're nobody right now and the king's trying to kill you, but I'm committing to this program literally to put myself at risk in order to help you. But in return, I want a favor. And he says, I don't only want you to protect my life. If I'm in danger and you have opportunity to save me, I don't just want you to help me while I'm alive. What else does he want? Verse 15, but also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. Meaning his children and his descendants. Thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Eternal hath cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth. Jonathan has the vision to see, and I'm sure that is by God's inspiration, what is coming. He, unlike Saul, well, I think Saul knows it too because he's already acknowledged in chapter 19 that God is backing up David. Everything is going David's way. He has the respect of the army, the respect of all the people of Israel. His wife, the king's daughter, loves him. You know, everything David touches turns out golden. And we already read that last time, that Saul acknowledged that he had the favor of God, and yet he still now is opposing David, which means he's choosing to oppose God. Jonathan's taken a totally different approach. He recognizes the favor that David has with God, and he's saying, I want to be on God's side. I don't want to be one who is fighting against God's chosen man. He believes what God is going to do. So he doesn't want to be among the enemies, literally, that get destroyed. And that's going to happen. God is going to fight for David in the coming chapters. And the enemies of David are going to be defeated because he is God's chosen man. And Jonathan recognizes that and says, I want favor from God so that when God destroys the enemies of David, I and my family are not part of the ones that have to be destroyed. Also shall not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Eternal hath cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth. Verse 16, so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let the Eternal even require it at the hand of David's enemies. So Jonathan is acknowledging that David will become the king by God's decree instead of him. Here, Jonathan is the heir currently of the current anointed of God, and yet he's willingly giving up his claim to the throne in favor of David, and he's just asking for faith. Because what would normally happen? When one family usurps control of the throne from another family, What does the new king do? What happens throughout history? You kill all of the remaining heirs of the previous family. Because if you don't, one of those sons or grandsons or great-grandsons will later gain a following, and because he has the blood of the former king, will have a legitimate, quote, claim to the throne and be a threat to the existing new government. So what did they do? And they've done it all through human history. A usurper comes in, successfully takes over, gets rid of the current king. You get rid of not only the current king, but all of his children. You kill them all to protect your right and for your family and your children to have the throne from then on. That's what's going on here. Jonathan is saying, I'm willingly giving up my claim to the throne, but in return, I want God's promise and David's covenant that he will protect me and my sons to come, rather than destroying them, which is the automatic thing that they do when they come to power. I want to be protected. Let the Eternal even require it at the hand of David's enemies. Verse 17, and Jonathan caused David to swear again, to vow, to promise, because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. This was a serious compact between these two men. Commentators emphasize that this makes the covenant now. It wasn't in chapter 18. It was just a covenant between the two of them, David and Jonathan. Now that covenant is being expanded and becoming intergenerational. Jonathan protects David now from the threat of his father. David, in return, promises to protect and to show kindness to Jonathan and his family in future generations. Now, what's going to happen? I'll give you the answer in the back of the book, but all you need to do is read forward the remainder of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, because we'll get to these storylines eventually, but I'll tip you off. David follows through and honors his covenant with Jonathan. Oh, and it is pressed, because when David does come to the throne ultimately, then the first thing that all of his henchmen and his close advisors want to do is exactly what every other king does, destroy all the descendants from the previous dynasty, get rid of them. But David is going to honor that covenant after Saul and Jonathan are both killed on the battlefield. It's going to take him 7 more years after that before he becomes king over all of Israel, not just Judah, as we're going to see. But then David, now he's got the power. He becomes king. How does he use it? This is one of the things that makes David and his character different. He does save one of the sons of Jonathan, Mephibosheth. It's hard for me to say that. That story, by the way, is in 2 Samuel chapter 4. You can read that. Otherwise, this son, who also is lame, by the way, would have been killed. David goes out of his way to protect this son of Jonathan. And Jonathan then has descendants for multiple generations. That's proved in 1 Chronicles chapter 8, literally with the genealogy that shows Jonathan's descendants. Now, it doesn't tell us, the Bible doesn't go on to tell us what happens to the line of Jonathan, if any of them survive for any length of time, but at least I think 4 or 5 generations. So did David fulfill his promise, and did God fulfill the covenant as well that was made in his presence between these two men? Yeah, because his descendants did survive instead of getting wiped out like you would expect to happen. All right, so now they're going to set up a signal system. How's Jonathan going to get the news, either thumbs up or thumbs down, on Saul's intent? Because as you're going to find out, Saul is wise to Jonathan's, passing on this information onto his enemy. And so how is Jonathan going to communicate? They need a signal system. Verse 18, then Jonathan said to David, tomorrow is the new moon, and thou shalt be missed, because thy seat will be empty. And when thou hast stayed 3 days, now this is happening on the day before the new moon begins, so you've already got this count, is including today and tonight. When thou hast stayed 3 days, including the current day, the new moon day, the second day of the feast, and then up till the morning following. Then thou shalt go down quickly and come to the place where thou didst hide thyself when the business was in hand, and shall remain by the stone Ezel. Okay, we've got a few things. We've not heard of this stone Ezel, but obviously, or apparently, it was a big stone marker out in this field, almost like if you were coming into the city or exiting the city, it was kind of one of those markers that would tell you, like you're almost there. So Jonathan's instructing David to return to the same familiar hiding spot that they had used before with what he's called when the business was at hand. And that's referring back to the story we already read. The first time that David needed to figure out where Saul's trying to kill him or not. That was 1 Samuel 19, 2 through 7. Verse 20. Jonathan says, and I will shoot three arrows on the side thereof as though I shot at a mark. Now, we're not talking about, I think about that like to the side of the, no, he's talking, he's either going to shoot his arrow short in front of the target or else he's going to shoot them long beyond the target. And this is going to be part of the signal so David will know Saul's intent. Verse 21, and behold, I will send a lad saying, go, find out the arrows. If I expressly say unto the lad, behold, the arrows are on this side of thee, then take them, then come thou, for there is peace to thee and no hurt, as the eternal liveth. So if he shoots his arrow short and tells the little boy he's got out there running to pick up his arrows, you know, I shot short, go and pick up the arrows. David's going to hear it from his hiding place, and he's going to know there's peace. Saul's not trying to kill him. Verse 22, but if I say thus unto the young man, behold, the arrows are beyond thee. Go thy way. He's telling David, that's your signal to run. If I tell this little boy, no, my arrows went beyond where you're at, you need to go out further to retrieve them, that's going to be David's signal. Saul's trying to kill him. For the eternal hath sent thee away. Verse 23, and as touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of, behold, the eternal be between thee and me forever. Again, Jonathan's committing to the fact, I'm going to tell the truth on this. He's saying to David, I promise you, I'm going to tell you whether my father is out to get you or not. You can trust the signal that I send you. All right, verse 24, Saul's intentions become clear. So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon was come, the king sat him down to eat meat, or his meal, and the king sat upon his seat, as at other times, even upon the seat by the wall. And I don't know what this, I didn't take the time to look this up, but as paranoid as Saul is, I view this kind of like Saul's place at the royal table was always with his back to the wall, what I would call like the gunfighter's chair. When I go into a restaurant, I always see that. People, you go in with a big group and sit, and the one that's with the back to the wall, that's the gunfighter's chair. That means nobody can sneak up behind you. You've got everybody in front of you where you can see what they're doing. So that, I don't know, that's, it's just even upon a seat by the wall. And Jonathan arose, and Abner, remember, that's Saul's chief general, his military advisor. And Abner sat by Saul's side, and David's place was empty. So the new moon feast comes along. Saul's expecting David to be there, along with all of the other high-ranking members of the royal court. David's not there. His seat is empty. Verse 26, nevertheless, Saul spake not anything that day. He didn't say anything about David's absence that day. For he thought, so now you're seeing God is revealing what was in Saul's mind. He thought, something hath befallen him, he's not clean. Surely he's not clean. Now, what's that about? Now we're talking about ritual, likely ritual purity, according to the sacrificial system that was in force. This word clean is the Hebrew word tahor, T-A-H-O-R. It means clean or pure. Sometimes it can carry the connotation of morality, like in Psalm 51, verse 10, where David prayed, create in me a clean heart, same word. Okay? But most of the time, this was speaking about the instructions that God gave to the Israelites for ritual purity. So what would keep you from being able to participate in a sacrifice, not only on a holy day or a Sabbath, but also on a new moon feast? For instance, touching a dead body. So if you had touched the dead body of an animal, or let's say somebody in your family died and you were the one that actually prepared the body for burial, and it was within 24 hours of a feast, whether a new moon or a Sabbath or holy day, then you were considered ritually impure and not able to participate. What did that have to do with? Well, that's reminding you and me for the New Testament era about the need for us to come under the shed blood of Jesus Christ in order to be clean, to be right with God, to be able to have communion with Him. So this was a command to the ancient Israelites to remind them of things that made them impure. So what this is saying is Saul just assumed, because David wasn't there, he must have violated one of those list of things that would make you ritually impure for being able to celebrate, to be able to show up and partake. Now the point is, and what you're going to find out in the next verse, is that if that happened and you were ritually impure, the only thing you had to do was go through this process of washing, and then at sunset that night, you were clean. So even though if it were true, let's say David touched a dead body, and therefore he could not, by God's law, show up on the new moon feast celebration, he should be able to show up the next day. So Saul didn't get upset the first day when David wasn't there. But he absolutely expected him to be there on day two. Verse 27. And it came to pass on the morrow, on the second day after the new moon, which was the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. Again, 2 days in a row. And Saul said unto Jonathan his son, wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to dinner, to meat? Neither yesterday nor today. 2 days in a row he's missed. What gives? And Jonathan, verse 28, answered Saul with the lie that David and he had pre-prepared. Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, David said, let me go, I pray thee, for our family hath a sacrifice in the city, and my brother, he hath commanded me to be there. And now if I have found favor in thy eyes, let me get away, I pray thee, and see my brother, and therefore he cometh not unto the king's table. Lie, 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 lie. But that's the story Jonathan told his father. How does Saul reply? Verse 30. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. Yeah. Saul saw right through it. Just like at the beginning of the chapter, remember that disagreement Jonathan and David had over whether Saul was really out to get him or not, or whether Jonathan would continue as a confidant of his father. Don't worry, I'm always going to be in my father's inner circle, and I'll be able to tell you. It looks like David was the one who was right. Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said unto him, thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman. I mean, then you like slander his mother. Thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion? He says, don't you think I know? You have picked David, who is literally your enemy. Because Saul is thinking about it from the standpoint of Jonathan and the family dynasty. He says, don't you think I know you've aligned yourself with your own enemy? Who's going to take away your right to the throne? And unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness, which is an old English way of saying, make your mother ashamed that she ever gave birth to you. It's really what he's saying. Don't you know that your choice to align yourself with David is an absolute shame? And he says it's the most foolish thing you could ever do, because you're signing your own death warrant. So Saul takes out his wrath upon Jonathan, treating his own son like an enemy, which is exactly what David, in essence, warned him about. He says, Saul already knows. And now, Jonathan, apparently for the first time, is faced with the hard truth. It smacks him in the face that is absolutely true. Verse 31, Saul continuing, "For as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, that thou not be established, nor thy kingdom, you will never," he says, "even if I die, Jonathan, and you take the throne in my place, you'll never have peace. You'll never have security for yourself or your family dynasty as long as David is alive. He will always be a threat to the throne." And Saul was dead right about that. But as I've already told you, he also knew he was fighting God, not just David. He knew God was the one who picked David, and yet he's still going to try to destroy him. "Thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die." Go, so he was playing this nicey-nice game after his, you know, religious experience with the Levites and Samuel and Ramah. Now he's back to being outwardly honest about his real intention, which is to kill David by any means, by hook or by crook. And he tells Jonathan, "You go and find him and bring it to me, because I'm going to kill him." Verse 32. Now, how does Jonathan reply? This is the first time we see anger, at least described from Jonathan. Verse 32. "And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said unto him, Wherefore shall he be slain? What has he done? What justice are you pursuing, trying to kill David, who has done nothing to you?" And Saul cast a javelin at him to smite him, at his own son. Now, he's already done this twice. Well, two different instances, three javelin throws at David. Twice in the first, once in the second. And now he's throwing the javelin, trying to kill his own son. This is a habit. "Saul cast a javelin at him and smite him, whereby Jonathan knew that it was determined of his father to slay David." There's no talking his father out of it. There's no appeasing him. There's no finding common ground. Verse 34, "So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger." So it looks like Saul's sitting at the table with his back to the wall, had his javelin handy, and literally threw it at his son while he was still sitting at the table. I don't know. Because after Jonathan dodges the javelin, it says he arose from the table in fierce anger and did eat no meat. He didn't eat any food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had done him shame. So, ironically, Saul is treating Jonathan as if he's done the king and the dynasty of Saul shame. You know, saying he's ashamed to his mother. Jonathan, in turn, is treating it as if his father has acted shamefully. And he has. Because of trying to assassinate an innocent man. Jonathan now is facing what David already told him was true. But Jonathan comes to the realization finally. Next, starting in verse 35, we find that Jonathan keeps his word. He follows through on his commitment to David to tell him the truth. Verse 35, "It came to pass in the morning that Jonathan went out." So now it must be the morning after the 2 days of the feast. It was 2 days of feasting, not three. And now on the morning of day three, he goes out into the field with his archery equipment in order to fulfill this signal to David. "Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David and a little lad with him. And he said unto this lad, Run, find out now the arrows which I shoot. Go and find the arrows that I'm going to shoot. And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him, way out in front of him, made him run for it. Verse 37, "And when the lad was come to the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried after the lads." Light. So this is the way, their signal. Why go through all of this stuff? In case Saul had spies following Jonathan, preventing or using Jonathan as a lure, follow Jonathan because he's going to meet up at some time with David, and then there's your opportunity to get David. So this is what all this intricate signaling is all about. It's a way to defeat the potential spies of Saul who are trying to use Jonathan as a means to find David. Oh, Jonathan's just going out for some archery practice. No big deal. When the lad had come to the place where the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond thee?" And he's yelling this out to the lad downrange, loud enough for David to hear, being in hiding. And Jonathan cried after the lad, "Make speed, haste, stay not." He's in essence talking to the lad, telling him, run fast to retrieve the arrows, but really he's talking to David. Make speed, haste. Don't stay here. Your life's in danger. My father's trying to kill you. Run as fast as you can. And Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came to his master. But the lad knew not anything. He didn't know what the signals that were really going on. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. Verse 40, and Jonathan gave his artillery unto his lad and said unto him, go, carry them back to the city. Okay. So then we're going to find in verse 41 that David comes out of hiding. And we're like, well, if David could come out of hiding after this whole thing, why go through the motions anyway? Again, likely because they didn't know. Were there going to be spies following Jonathan? Was he going to have an opportunity or not in order to communicate the message to David? So apparently, even though the storyline doesn't tell us, there must not have been any spies because it became safe for David to come out and actually have a personal conversation here with Jonathan. Verse 41, and as soon as the lad was gone, David arose out of the place toward the south and fell on his face to the ground and bowed himself three times. He's acknowledging before God that he knows the king of Israel is trying to kill him. He's his mortal enemy, and there's no way to get around it. It's not going to be undone. Saul's not going to change his mind. He's not truly going to repent. He's not truly going to invite David back into his court. Those days are over. And they kissed one another and wept with another until David exceeded. And this isn't some, you know, homosexual thing, which is what there are people who want to do that. You know, they want to say like Bert and Ernie and Sesame Street are like, you know, faggots. And that's not true either. Neither was Jonathan and David. So anyway, verse 42, Jonathan said to David, go in peace for as much as we have sworn both of us in the name of the Eternal, saying, the Eternal be between me and thee and between my seed and thy seed forever, an intergenerational covenant that they made. And they're both intent on fulfilling it. And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. All right, that takes us to the end of chapter 20. Next time, we're going to continue with the storyline in chapter 21, David being on the run.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 20th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, January 17th, 2026.